So for this evening's talk, again, another request, but this time a unique request, a bit strange, because many of you know that these talks go to many other different places in the world, not just here in Perth. And it was today some of our Singapore followers, you know, who actually started off the Bodhinyana Limited in Singapore. So it's, you know, we call that franchises. So just like we had McDonald's started off in one restaurant, so this is my franchise, Bodhinyana Monastery down in Perth, franchises all over the world. We have the Ajahn Brahm Society in Colombo, Sri Lanka. We have the Brahm Center in Singapore, Bodhinyana International Foundation in Hong Kong. You see where this is going to end up. We're soon going to be bigger than Google. Maybe not, but anyway. Well, anyway, so it's still, we have, especially people in Singapore, they wanted me to give a talk, something like in recognition of their deceased first Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew, who passed away, but also that they don't know in Singapore that the Prime Minister of Australia, a former one, passed away recently. And so that the talk I was giving today, you know, for both these people, and just in general, was a talk on leadership. Now, this is not just leadership in governments. It's leaderships in little offices, leaderships in communities, and eventually, the most important type of leadership, leadership of your own life and the way you're living. We start off with the big leadership. It was Malcolm Fraser, who was the old Prime Minister who died in Australia, from Australia this week. We know that because just coming in today saw the flags at half mast, and it's because he died. So people are always dying, but it gives us a time to recognize, you know, just the importance of leadership in our world and how the fact is that it's very hard to find good leaders today. They're important. And so first of all, I would say just sometimes the way that leadership emerges is a little bit strange, because first of all, in our world, usually leaders are elected by people. And even if we elect our leaders, still it doesn't give them much authority, because we've been electing our prime ministers in Australia for a long time now, and we keep changing them all the time because we don't like them. Still, they don't really have the authority where they can truly lead people. And other leaders in the world, they just take authority. They assume the mantle of power. And again, that doesn't really amount to leadership. It's just a leadership from fear. But the best leaders are those who just grow into the role, just with the authority of experience and the character which they have developed over the years. They do become leaders who grow into that role. They are very rare but very wonderful when we have people who are natural leaders. Actually, I wouldn't call them grown leaders, they just become leaders after the time, after many weeks, months, years sometimes. But what sort of qualities, you know, do those leaders really have? And you know, one of the most important qualities of a leader is inspiration. And this is an important quality which is sometimes lacking in our world, which actually inspires people. They do hard things, difficult things, innovative things, which gives people hope. They give people like a view that there is goodness in our world and there is solutions to some of the deep problems. And one of the little emails somebody sent me, I forget actually who sent it to me, but it was a unique email because this was, of all things, a Muslim story. Sometimes that in our press in the West, people are really down on Muslims, on the Muslim community. But this apparently it was in Indonesia recently. I don't know if any of you saw this beautiful story. In a small village or town somewhere in Indonesia, a very poor woman was arrested and charged with stealing. And when her court case came up and the judge asked what she'd stolen, it was just a cassava plant, just a potato basically. And I asked her, what do you do that for? Because my kids were hungry If any of you read Les Miserables, you know, not just the movie or the play, but the book, which is very powerful, and that was where, you know, the hero of the piece, he was arrested and put in the prison ships for stealing a loaf of bread. And I always remember this, just, you know, reading this passage, and when the judge asked him, well, why did you steal? He said, because my children were hungry. And sometimes you think, my goodness, you know, who's done the crime? And in this particular case, this is real, it happened just recently. This poor woman had stolen a potato plant to feed her family. And the judge looked at the person who's bringing the charge, the shop owner, I'd imagine, almost begging him, why are you charging this woman for? Why are you prosecuting her? But the person insisted on prosecuting this woman for stealing a potato. And so the judge said, look, I've got no choice. I have to apply the law. There's no discretion. You have to be fined 1 million rupiah, which is, I think, about $100. 1 million rupiah or 2.5 years in jail. And now everyone's sort of gasped, and the poor woman, imagine that, you know, you're so poor you can't even feed your family, and now you have to find, you know, 1 million rupiah, $100, or 2.5 years in jail, who's going to feed my family? And the judge, after giving the verdict, took off his hat, put 1 million rupiah in the hat, and passed it around the court, and said, I'm also going to fine everybody in this courtroom 50,000 rupiah, $5 each, for the crime of allowing somebody to be so poor in this town they have to steal to feed their family. So everybody in the courtroom was also fined $5. And all that money was given to the poor woman who's stolen the cassava plant, so that she ended up with, you know, about $100 to $200 profit. Now that was a beautiful thing to do. That was innovative. It's just like that story I think I told a few weeks ago here in Western Australia, a judge up north who had this young indigenous kid so many times in his courtroom. He was only about 14 or 15, and said, look, what are we going to do with you? And he tried something innovative. He asked this kid, well, what do you dream about? Now, what would you really like in life? What is your biggest wish? And this little 14 or 15-year-old, very poor indigenous kid, said, well, I'd really like a bicycle. And so that's when the judge said, okay, if you keep your nose clean for 6 months, I'll buy you a bike. Case dismissed. And, of course, this kid actually kept his nose clean. He didn't get into any trouble for 6 months. He had something to live up to, something to wish for, something to dream for. And so after 6 months, the judge bought him a bike. And that was quite a few years ago. Now the guy is married with a good job. You know, that was the incident which turned his life around. Now that is leadership. That is inspiration. That is giving hope to people that there is a different way of doing things. The judge in Western Australia, he apparently got into trouble. Because you're not allowed to do that. You're supposed to apply the law, send him to jail. He did a bad thing. But is that really going to solve our problems? Sometimes we do need to take another tack, to do a different thing, to somehow find a different way of doing things to solve the problems of life. And that's what leadership is all about. Having ideas and being able to stand up and stick to those ideas. I don't know if I told you another story of how people may change. This was the leader of the gay community in Tasmania some years ago. It's a very interesting story, maybe controversial, but here it comes. You may know that, you know, in Tasmania was the last state in Australia, as far as I know, which made consensual homosexual sexual acts illegal. Even if you did it in the privacy of your bedroom, it was still against the law. And then for adult, consensual sex. And so the gay, lesbian, transgender lobby in Tasmania kept on asking the government to please, you know, change the law. This is not the 19th century, it's 21st century, you know, this is not acceptable, human rights. And every other state has changed the legislation. Why does Tasmania have to stand out? But you know what governments are like. No. Too difficult. We'll get into trouble. We'll lose the election, whatever it is. And so they had to do something a bit more drastic. Their leader came up with this very interesting idea. It was against the law to have consensual homosexual sex in Tasmania. So they got 100 couples, gay couples, all agreed to have lots and lots of sex one night, on the same night, and to keep a record of everything they did in detail. And the following morning, these 100 couples turned up at the local police station to hand themselves in. They say, "We've committed a crime. Here's the evidence. We're guilty. Arrest us." So 100 couples, gay couples, had to be arrested that same morning. And of course, the media found out about it. And that was enough to embarrass the government. I think within a couple of weeks, they amended the law. Now that was amazing sort of leadership. You know, doing something which is actually gets the job done, a good job done. You know, in a way which doesn't really hurt anybody, embarrasses, you know, the politicians, yes, but gets it done in a very beautiful, meaningful way. And sometimes when we don't have that leadership, that innovation, that inspiration, different ways of doing things to solve some of these huge problems in our world, what happens is that we lose hope. We distrust leaders, and we get leaders which basically do the same old stuff again and again and again and again without actually moving our societies forward. So the leadership has to be inspirational. And to be inspirational, you find that you don't need to be bossy as a leader, because that's one of the biggest mistakes. I know best, I'm going to order you all to do what I think you should do. The best leadership, you know, is that example, and I teach this when I go to business conferences and stuff like that, is, you know what it's like in your office? You have a boss, your leader. And what is that boss like? You know, do they inspire you, or do they drive you crazy? Just a real pain in the neck. And how many bosses are like that? And that's something very wrong with society when people don't know how to be leaders. And the story I tell people is from the Chinese Art of War, Sun Po's great classic. There's a lot of interesting stuff in those little books. It wasn't just about winning battles and the battlefield, it was also about winning the sort of the problems of life, solving the difficulties, settling things, bringing peace, prosperity inside of yourself and also in our nations and world. And that was the story of the general with the best discipline in the whole imperial army of China. You've heard this before, some of you, but this is such an important story, it comes up again. That was when this general had such great discipline, the soldiers never disobeyed him, so the emperor decided to find out the secret, you know, of leadership. So he asked the general to come into the court, and he asked the general, "Why is it? What is your secret? Why do your soldiers never disobey your orders?" And that's when the general replied, "Because they never disobey my orders, because I only order them to do what they already want to do. That's why they never disobey me." And when I first read that, like when you first hear it, you think, what's going on? How can you order a soldier to go into battle, and they want to go into battle? Because you're going to get wounded and even killed. Who would want to go into battle? Why would soldiers want to get up early in the morning to train? Why would they, you know, want to do all this hardship? How can you can order these soldiers and they want to do what you already order them to do? And of course, the answer was this wonderful thing called motivation. That general was such a beautiful, skilled motivator. that when he talked to his soldiers, he motivated, explained, inspired them so much that when he gave the order to get up early in the morning, they couldn't wait to get up early in the morning. Any of you have trouble with your children getting up early in the morning? You know what it's like, all the threats, all of the shouting. Does it work? No way. But if you can inspire them, motivate them. If, for example, there's some cricket match starting at 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock, no, you know what it's like. You know, they have World Cup cricket on now. I was just telling Ajahn Sujata, because this is an advertisement, he is doing an early Buddhism course on Sunday with Ajahn Bamali. A very great course all day. What time does it start? After lunch, the same time as the World Cup cricket final is on. I say, bad timing, Ajahn Sujata. A lot of people be watching the cricket rather than learning about Buddhism. Such is life. That happened to me once. I was in Adelaide, and that evening I was giving a talk, supposed to be giving a talk in the Sri Lankan temple. They're Buddhist, okay? Well, they're sort of Buddhist, because there's another religion which they value more than Buddhism, and that's cricket, because that evening Australia were playing Sri Lanka in the Adelaide Oval. Hardly anyone came to my talk. You know what it's like. Anyway, never mind. And Sri Lanka lost. And I told her, that's the reason why. If you'd have come to listen to the talk, make some good karma, then you may have won. But anyhow, I scolded the Sri Lankans. But anyhow, if you want to get up early to watch a cricket match, you can do it easily. If you need to get up because you're going on holiday overseas, you can do that easily. You can get up if you want to. And that's it. If you want your kids to get up early, motivate them. Give them some inspiration to want to get up early, because that's what this general would do. So when he rang the bell or the horn, whatever it was, to get the soldiers, they were up immediately. When he said, "We're training today. We're training all day." Yes, give us more. We'd love training. And when it came to the battle, they couldn't wait to fight. That's called motivation. That is why our committee, why it's so easy to get committee members, because I've been motivating people all year. So when it comes to next year, yes, I want to work my butt off to be the secretary this year. Yeah. You see, I'm sorry about that. I know all about psychology. There was, you know, one year, I don't mind telling these stories, be careful of Ajahn Brahm, okay, and the other monks. You know, it's amazing just how we can manipulate you guys. We were looking, it's true. We were looking for our president a few years ago, and, you know, it's supposed to be democracy, okay, but, you know, it's sort of democracy. Because we usually choose beforehand and then elect them. Similar to Singapore. Okay, Singapore, you know that's true. But anyway, she admits this, it happened. There was one person who was, you know, would made a really, really good president, and that was Rachel. She's not here this evening, she's over in Armidale. And so I asked her, saying, "Can you nominate for president next year?" And no, she said, like many people, "No, I'm too busy. Too much stuff to do. I've got a business, I've got a family. I just can't handle it." So then Ajahn Brahm's psychology comes in. And I said, "Oh, yeah, you know, that's right, yeah. No, sorry, I shouldn't have asked you. Look, please don't think about it. I know your character. You may feel guilty afterwards because, you know, you refused me. I've done a lot to you. But please remember, don't feel guilty about this. And in fact, to stop you feeling guilty, you know, I'm actually going to ban you from being president next year. It's actually verboten. No matter what you say, even if you nominate afterwards, I'm going to ban you. You can't stay. Okay, remember that. You can't be president." And I know her character. She went back. "What does he mean? I can't be president. Who does he think he is to ban me for being president?" And so she nominated, and well, she was elected. And she admits I got into her and I twisted her brain. So that's how she became president that year. But anyway, so you motivate people. You don't need to order them and force them. A good leader inspires people so they want to do the right thing. And those are the most beautiful leaders you find. Whether it's in the office, whether it's in the company, or it's in the country, those inspirational leaders, you look at them, and they have an ideal, something which we all want to live up to. That's why people come here. You know, my ideal is having some compassion and kindness, being at peace with one another, just learning how to find peace in your own mind. No, forgiving. And I just was in Brisbane last week. I travel around too much. But it's great, because even I told a story a couple of weeks ago. Came from 2 years ago. I'm sure he doesn't mind me saying this. But it was a Sri Lankan man who was estranged from his son. Hadn't spoken to his son for 7 years. 7 years they had some sort of argument for it. I don't care what it was. And they refused to speak with each other or even go in the same house and room. A father and a son and father, separated like that. So when I went to this guy's house for a meal one day, because I was in Brisbane at the time, so they took me there. And when I heard that, he said, got any other children here? My other son is here. So I think, if I remember correctly, I asked the other son, give your brother a call, the one who's estranged, and summon him by order of Ajahn Brahm to come to the house now. And sometimes, you know, I've got a good reputation. Sometimes people are scared of me, my powers. And so he came. And so, you know, there's father and son. I force them to speak to each other and say sorry to each other, forgive each other. Not, it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong. I could inspire them enough to do that. And so they reconciled. And I saw the two of them a couple of days ago. They came to my talk in Brisbane. I was there just on Wednesday night. And they came to my talk, you know, together, standing, laughing together. That gives me so much happiness. Father and son, separated for 7 years, and I got them back together again. Forgiving, that's inspiring. That is leadership. That is actually giving people hope. And to this day, I don't know what they did, why they did that. And sometimes it doesn't really matter. Sometimes we don't remember why we're estranged, but I'm not going to speak to them anyway. I don't know why. I forget now, but no way I'm going to speak to him or her. Now, this is a beautiful part about leadership. It's leading, of course, by example. I couldn't do that, you know, if I, you know, had sort of problems with other people. You have to do it, you know, with authority. Now, authority is having walked the talk yourself for many years beforehand, which is one of the problems with leadership. Before we lead others, we have to lead ourselves. And to be able to lead ourselves, you know, we have to do the same, inspire ourselves. If we want to actually to change the way we do some of the things we do, to change some of the speech, you know, which we have, and especially to change some of the attitudes we have to ourselves. And the way we do that is inspire ourselves. Because that inspiration motivates you to change even your attitudes, you know, towards life. And you know, the most common attitude which people have in our Western world, which, you know, is the problem, is the way we regard ourselves. Lack of self-esteem, not good enough, not beautiful enough, not smart enough, not anything enough. And this is one of the biggest problems in our Western world. And the only way to overcome that is inspiring yourself, which means looking at the other part of yourself. The very simple exercise, which is not that hard to do, is the piece of paper exercise. You get a piece of paper and you draw a line down the middle. You put your name at the top, just like you used to do at school. And on the left-hand side, you put all the reasons why you're hopeless, why you're really bad, why you can't do anything in life. You know, all the bad jokes I say. No, today's bad joke. This is really a bad one. I told this the other day, it's an old joke, but it's terrible, about the guy who goes into the psychiatrist. He said, "What's your problem, sir?" And he says, "You know, well, sometimes I imagine that I'm a marquee. You know, a marquee? You know, have them on these events. And sometimes I think I'm a wigwam, you know, a teepee, an Indian thing." And he said, "And sometimes I flip between the two. Sometimes I think I'm a marquee, sometimes I think I'm a wigwam." And the psychologist thinks for a while, and the psychiatrist says, "That's, I never heard that before." But then psychiatrist gets a light bulb, goes on his head, "I know it, I've got your problem. Sometimes you think you're a marquee, sometimes you think you're a wigwam. Your problem, sir, is you're too tense." I told you that was a bad joke. You could have put your fingers in your ears. But anyhow, you see, that's, so I'd put that on my column, telling bad jokes. And, but then, fill out the left side of the column, all your reasons why you've got low self-esteem. This is serious. All the reasons why you're hopeless at this, you can't get a relationship, you know, you're ugly, you're fat. This is why I'm like this. To make all the other people who are fat not feel so bad. This is out of compassion to you. I'm happy, I'm healthy. So there you go. So you can be like Ajahn Bob. Look at me. Like when I was young, I had, you know, there was very few, you know, on the TV, on the movies, very few sort of images of religious people I could really look up to and respect. And the one image, the one person who became what I wanted to live up to as a monk, you know, just the role model I thought was just, yeah, that's what I want to be later on. And that was, you know, in the Robin Hood series, Friar Tuck. Remember Friar Tuck? So that was my inspiration. He was always really kind and happy and jolly. He used to like to eat a lot. So if you're a monk, why not? Anyway, the other one I really look up to, the kindest and healthiest person in the world. This guy's been living for hundreds of years, and he's really fat too. Santa Claus. I remember him, he was old when I was young, and he's still going strong. Anyway, let's get back to, so all the things on the left-hand column, things which are wrong with you, fat, ugly, hopeless, tell bad jokes, whatever it is, all, that's on the left-hand column. On the right-hand column, you have to write all the things which you respect about yourself, your good qualities. Well, I remember doing this with somebody once. Actually, a few times. I get the piece of paper. Okay, here's the paper. Name on the top. The left-hand column, all your bad qualities. You know how easy that is to do? You can do that in half a sheet of paper. It's not big enough. They start writing in the margins and small things. And this, well, yeah, I'm terrible at this too. Then in the right-hand column, all the things you respect about yourself. I remember just this one guy. He said, nothing there. Don't respect anything. So I had to help him. You know, have you got a cat? Yeah, I got a cat. Fed it some milk this morning. That down there. Fed the cat some milk. And the interesting thing about this little method, this psychology, is once you get the first thing, it's a crack in the damn wall. The second thing is, you know, much quicker to get out. And then the third one, the fourth one. And this person, after they get the third or fourth really good quality in themselves written down on a piece of paper, the rest flow down really quickly, and they have to fill in the spaces and the margins with their good qualities too. And once they start to do that, and they're writing it down, and then I don't stop them, and wait till they're finished. And they say, "Look at that, look what you've just done." And they realize it's just because we get caught up in negativity. So we can't see anything else, we're just totally looking one-sided at the left-hand side of the paper. You just need a monk or nun or somebody to turn you around and see the other part. And once you see it, it's there. All those beautiful good qualities are there in all human beings. That's why, you know, in Mahayana Buddhism, they say everyone's got Buddha nature. It's a very beautiful concept. Everyone inside of you, every one of you, you know, even Tony Abbott has got Buddha nature. I know a few of you are shaking your heads, but No. Everyone has. When you see it inside, they've got this beautiful... No, he's a good, reasonably good guy. Is when you see those things inside of them, they realize it themselves. They have that. And then when you write it down, the next part of the exercise is tear the paper down the middle. And the negative side, throw it away. It doesn't belong. And keep the beautiful side. Keep it in your wallet. Photocopy it, laminate it, put it on your desk at work, put it by your bedside. All these beautiful qualities you recognize from yourself. Because that inspires you. You see beautiful stuff in yourself. Things which once you focus on will grow bigger, stronger and deeper inside of you. Once you notice those qualities, you are leading your own self, your character, your beauty in the life to grow more and more and more. That is inspirational. Just like a great leader makes a gesture of peace, of harmony, and once they make the gesture, it leads everybody to follow it, do the same, do more, do it better. It grows and grows and grows. It's called leadership in your own life. If we don't have that leadership, we don't inspire ourselves. It's just too easy to get depressed, to get cynical, and just to sort of basically to wilt, to wither away. Your Buddha nature is inside there, but it's withered. It just needs that bit of inspiration, that rain, you know, after the long dry summertime to start getting things growing. Just like in the forest right now, those first rains last week, things, the grass is coming up, it's beautiful. You know those grass seeds were already underneath the ground. They just needed the seed to get them growing. Sometimes when people are really depressed, when life is very difficult, when you're having a very bad time, when everything is going wrong, you just don't know what's going to happen next and how you can get out of this. You know, I grew up in Northern Europe, you know, in England, and January, February, everything is so dead. You know, you go into the forests, you know, in Europe, North Europe, there's no leaves on the trees. It's incredible to see, they're just skeletons there, and there's no flowers or nothing alive, and even the animals, they've just disappeared. They're hibernating. Sleeping, hiding away from the cold. It looks desolate at that time of the year. That's why I tell you, if you're ever going to go to Europe, please don't go at Christmas time, January and February. It's just so grey and dull and drizzly. And then even I started getting depressed going at that time of the year. And if I get depressed, there's not much hope for you guys. So... but I always remember that story. You just go out into the forest, nothing is alive, just skeletons like the trees in some battlefield, nothing alive. But you know, because you've seen it before, that underneath the ground, all these seeds, all this life just waiting, the animals, the squirrels, the birds and everything else underneath there, they're all just waiting for the heat to come, for the warmth of kindness to come from the sun, from the rain to start, and everything just bursts. That's why just springtime in Northern Europe is one of the most beautiful times of the year. Springtime in Paris. That's what people sometimes even sing about. And that springtime in Paris is just the hope in your own heart in the miserable winters of your life. Never ever believe the winter lasts forever. It never does. You go through your winter times, we all do. But the leadership knows something is happening. The seeds are there. They're coming. And when they burst through, you forget all about the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, you're cured now, but you'll come again next winter.
for some more inspiration, more. But this is how one leads one's own life, with that wisdom, with that kindness, with that hope. You've seen it before, you just need to be reminded of it, and it works. Which means that you manage to almost tolerate everything in life, and it gives you hope, it gives you meaning, it gives you purpose. You are led, not by me, not by any other monk or nun, yourself. You grow. And this is how we get things to happen. Not by telling and ordering. The leadership of wisdom and kindness. Inspiration. And once that leadership is recognized in simple things, you lead yourself out of the difficulties of life. Then you can start to lead others. Because the leadership, you know, in a little office is exactly the same way that you led yourself out of those problems. Yeah, you've got all these difficulties, hard economic times, difficulty getting the right type of staff, difficulty in getting people to do the right thing when they always make mistakes. How can we do all of this? How can we lead in an office? And every time which I have seen successful businesses, inspiration is how it works. You know, just last 3 weeks ago in Google headquarters, in Facebook too, to see people, you know, they are working to all hours of the night. They just come in whenever you want, leave whenever you want, whenever you get your job done. But people give much more than the hours they're supposed to work because they're inspired. They're doing something. They're changing the world each in their own ways. Making this world into a really cool, beautiful, wonderful place. You know, Google cars. You know, where you don't have to drive anymore. You can just sit down and just relax. You can meditate on the way to work. You're just pressing the buttons where you need to go and off you go. And it'd be great, because as a monk I'm not allowed to drive a car, but I'm just waiting. Google cars. I don't have to have anybody driving me anymore. I just get in the car, Googling where I need to go. Don't need a driving license, you just go. Old people who can't drive when they get to a certain age, now they can drive. The car drives for them. You can't even see, you can't hear, you may be disabled. Get in a Google car, you can speak the destination in, and you can go anywhere you want. Wow, it's amazing. And of course, hopefully we have some Google aircraft. Can't trust pilots these days. So this is inspiration. When people get that sort of that hope and that vision for a really good future, you don't need to force them. That's the leadership, the inspiration, something, hope, goodness in our world. You know, stopping the wars between people. Just, I don't know how old you are, but you know, one of the most inspiring leaders was actually the Egyptian President Sadat. They're having this big war, Israel and Egypt, for years warring with each other, and just one day, I don't know if you know about this, but this President Sadat of Egypt, without any warning, no telephone calls, decided just to get on his plane and just go to Israel. Just landed without warning. Just, you know, really sort of scared the, you know what, out of the Israelis. The president of Egypt just coming on a visit, what does he want? He just went to go and see just the Israeli prime minister, just talk two of them together, and just create a peace pact. He'd had enough of war. And instead of going through his cabinet, instead of just discussing with the people, he said, no, enough, I'm going to do it. He had the authority to do it. He got assassinated afterwards. But it was worth doing. I would do that. Be assassinated to create peace between two warring nations. Would you do that? If you are, then you're a leader. Willing to sacrifice everything just for your goal. That's what Gandhi, who said, I can see 1,000 reasons to give my life for a good cause. 1,000 causes to give my life. But I can't see any reason to take the life of another. It's a very beautiful saying. But he was willing, and he did put himself on the line many, many times, willing
to make the greatest sacrifice. And Mandela did the same when he was sentenced to death. Or he was about to be sentenced to death. And he said, I think, forget what the story was, maybe you know this better than I, but he said, no, you know, if you're going to sentence me, I'm willing to die, you know, because of the apartheid regime in South Africa at the time, whatever it was. And that's a leader, because they're not really concerned about themselves. They're not really concerned about their own life. They are not as important as the cause for which they are leading. And of course, those leaders, when they don't think of themselves, they are the ones who are really, really impressive. Okay, you know, I'm a Buddhist. At least when I was reading about the present Pope, he doesn't stay in his presidential palace. He stays in a small apartment. That is leadership. If you're going to be a leader of a religion, if you are going to be someone who's trying to inspire other people, all the talks in the world won't be as powerful as what you actually do, how you behave. And that's really important for leadership, to be authentic, I think the word is, to walk the talk. Remember the old story of Gandhi again. Because he was a young man, he was in England, he was studying law, he was sent over there when he was a small kid. But apparently this story, I always like this story because it shows just the character of a person who would become a great leader. He was staying in an English boarding house and his landlady came up to him one day, according to this little anecdote, and said to him, "Mr. Gandhi, my son is eating too much sugar. And I've tried to tell him not to eat so much, but he won't listen to me." Children not listening to their parents is not a new thing. This was about 100 years ago. It's just it's just the nature of things, you know, it's just tradition. So if kids don't listen to you, they're just, you know, being traditional children. Actually, there's a saying from Socrates, because, you know, in his writings, now, he also said that children don't listen to parents. And that was in ancient Greece, you know, thousands of years ago. So anyway, so don't worry about your children, okay? Don't think my children are hopeless and terrible. They're just exactly like you were when you were young with your kids, with your parents. Now, that happened to me once. I was staying with my brother. And I got his two children, my nephew and niece. I was just chatting to them. And they said, what was my brother like? You know, their father when he was young. And I started telling all the stories of what he got up to when he was young, which they never heard before. And then my brother came in the room and just really said, "What are you telling my kids?" "So all the naughty stuff you did when you were young, because I was there as your brother." He said, stop it. "I tried to tell my kids not to do these things." But, you know, I know my brother, he did the same, I would do the same. But anyway, that's why we love kids. You know, they're just kids being kids. Adults being adults, monks being monks, nuns being nuns. But anyway, going back to Gandhi, they said, "No, but my son won't listen to me, but, you know, he respects you. I don't know why, but he respects you. I think if you tell my son, please not take so much sugar, maybe, he may listen to you." So Mr. Gandhi said, "Yes, madam, I'll tell your son." The days went past, the weeks went past, and the son was still taking lots of sugar. And so the landlady went up to Mr. Gandhi for a second time. "Mr. Gandhi, do you remember that conversation I had with you 2 weeks ago where I asked you to tell my son not to take so much sugar?" "Yes, ma'am, I remember that." "Well, why haven't you told my son he's still taking so much sugar?" "But I have told your son, madam, but only this morning." "Why did you wait 2 weeks?" "Because only yesterday, madam, that I stopped eating sugar." Now that is what makes a leader. You have to have authority. You can't tell other people to give up eating sugar if you're still eating sugar yourself. You can't tell other people, you know, to sort of cut back on your costs, you know, when you are wasting so much money yourself. You can't tell other people to be forgiving when you still got your enemies. You can't tell other people to be kind when you're getting angry. Leadership has to be done for yourself, first of all. you have to, as they say, walk that talk. I remember in Singapore, I'm sure those people listening remember this anecdote. I had a free morning in another temple. It was the Buddhist library over in Singapore. They were raising some money for some project because, you know, we never charge for anything, always raising money for this and raising money for that. And anyway, he was a friend. I had a free morning. They were doing a charity walk, you know, for raising funds. You know, they do that in Australia as well, charity walks. And so I went there, and because, you know, I was well known, I was a dignitary, they asked me to give a talk, you know, to start the walk. So I gave a talk, and following me was one of the Singaporean ministers. You know, in the, was it the PAP, you know, the governing party of started by Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore. And he gave a talk as well. And after he finished his talk, I said, "Are you coming on the walk?" Because I was going on the walk. He said, "No." And I told him, he said, "Oh, you're one of these politicians who talks the walk, but never walks a talk." And that's what he was. He was talking a walk. I said, "That's the wrong thing to do. You should walk the talk, not talk the walk. Otherwise, you've got no authority. You're not really a leader." So each one of you, lead your mind in kindness and practice it as well. Make it happen. Find somebody this next week you can forgive. Someone who's hurt you. Someone who's cheated you. Someone who's not done the right thing. I challenge you to walk the talk and to say, "I forgive you. Please forgive me." Try it. There's one of the people here, one of the Thai young men. He's not young, he's actually quite old now, but he looks young. And some of the Thai people here know who I'm talking about. And, you know, he had an argument with his sister, you know, just over a will, usually. And, you know, he's really upset his sister wouldn't talk to her. So I was in the car with him and I told him, "What are you doing? Just ring up your sister and just make friends. It doesn't matter if she did something wrong. You know, your sister, you're a brother. You should go out and have dinner with each other." So he did. And he thanked me so much, you know, for getting him to forgive his sister. And now he's just happy. He said, "You are my teacher because I made him forgive his sister." Even though it looked like his sister was in the wrong, but I don't know. But who's in the right, who's in the wrong? You're both in the wrong if you haven't forgiven yet. So try that. Lead by example. And if you can start forgiving, then imagine where that might lead in your life. Don't ever think, "Oh, if I forgive, worse things will happen." Yeah, can it get much worse than it already is? Terrorism, wars, people just getting so depressed, you know, they crash the planes and goodness knows what else happens. We can do better than that. So, lead, each one of you, little ways. Lead your family, forgiving everyone, being kind to people, sharing more. Lead. Then when we lead, maybe our politicians lead. Because after all our politicians, whether it's a Malcolm Fraser or Lee Kuan Yew, aren't they representatives of us? Any faults they have is reflecting the faults in ourselves. So easy to criticize, say, a Tony Abbott or a David Cameron or a Mr. Key in New Zealand, so easy to criticize from a distance. But they're just reflecting the ordinary people who put them into power, us. So if we can lead, if we can change, then they will too. Change yourself, first of all, and then the government changes. You have to start. You are the leaders of Australia. Thank you. Thank you, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu. So I hope you like that over in Singapore because you're all listening specially dedicated to Lee Kuan Yew, to Malcolm Fraser and to all the people in the world. Okay, some questions now. Let's see if I got into trouble again. Any questions from the floor, first of all? Can't see anybody with their hands up. So let's get the questions from overseas. Da-da-da. We have one from England, United States and Spain today. It's very nice. So one first from England, from Mr. D. Cameron. No, I'm making that up. What should one do if one has a boss who is aggressive to myself and others? Is wanting other people not to be aggressive towards me coming from my ego? Should I stay and put up with it? Now, of course, that's a big question. If the aggression is really harassment and you're having a lot of problems with that, of course, you've got to go and take it to a higher level. That, in many countries, is illegal. If it is a little bit of aggression, it's very bossy, just the ordinary boss, then you can actually change that. What you do to change them is actually to change your way you look at that bossy person. And it's a fascinating piece of psychology. The way you look at them, look at their kindness. They have got a nice part inside of them. Don't just get that piece of paper and just look at their rotten parts. Get a piece of paper, write the name boss on the top, or the reason they're aggressive, rotten, terrible, up their backside, at least that's where they should be. Write that all down on the left-hand side, and then on the right-hand side of the paper, write all the things you appreciate and like about that boss. Do that. And then once you've filled the right-hand side piece of the paper, tear it down the middle, keep the right-hand side, all the good qualities, and keep looking at that throughout the day. And you'll find what you look for, that's what you'll find. The bossy part of your boss will tend to vanish, and you see the nice part. What you see in another person is what they show you back. Look for the nice part. Try it. It's incredible how amazing that works. The old story, this was from Venerable Hui Khan. She had a disciple whose, she was a Vietnamese girl, married an Australian guy, and her mother-in-law, this Australian woman, would never like, you know, the wife of her son. Never good enough for my boy, especially Asian. That's what, you know, she thought. And so it doesn't matter how kind and caring and sensitive the daughter-in-law was, she always got rubbish back from her mother-in-law. And had, you know, she loved her husband. Husband loved her, but trouble with mother-in-law. So how she solved that? Brilliant. She went to the temple, meditated, hopeless. Didn't work. Tried loving kindness meditation. The power of metta. Didn't work. Tried praying. May my mother-in-law like me. Never worked. But one day she was at the temple and, you know, she fell asleep. And she had this vision in her sleep. Now, you may know the Mahayana goddess of mercy, Kuan Yin. You may have seen that in the pictures, a statue of the goddess of mercy. And she dreamt of the statue of mercy, compassion, Kuan Yin. And it was just like the ordinary statue you see in any Chinese temple, except for one thing, the face. It had everything else like Kuan Yin, but the face was her mother-in-law's. And that really shocked her. She woke up. And that changed her whole attitude to her mother-in-law. Every time she saw her mother-in-law, she saw the goddess of mercy, Kuan Yin. And because she saw that in her mother-in-law, kindness, compassion, then that's what her mother-in-law started showing her back. And she said after a few weeks, had this beautiful, such loving, caring relationship with her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law regarded her just like a daughter. And she regarded her just like a biological mother. Just change their attitude. Very lovely story. United States, so when you say your boss, imagine if you're terrified, imagine the Buddha, but with your boss's face. From United States, how can one maintain right intention in a leadership role, especially one which has a lot of power? So the right intention, when you have a lot of power, sometimes that leaders, they just have to stand up and be stronger. So, well, even if you sort of kick me out, I'm not in here to win the next election. I'm in here just to, you know, win sort of the goodness, the right, the joy, the peace, the happiness of the people. Not to win the election. That's one of the problems, that, especially in Australia, the elections are just a little bit too soon. So it doesn't really give people the time. One of the things with politicians, I think we should do away with, you know, the usual type of, we should outsource our government, privatize it. So, you know, we can actually just select, just, you know, people, it doesn't have to be Australian. Just, you know, if we want a prime minister, maybe, you know, the Senate, the Congress, you know, Senate, Congress, the House of Reps or whatever, yeah, we elect them. But our prime minister, we select from people all around the world to see, you know, just who is a really nice person. Because if they're not Australian, they'd be like objective. You know, and they could actually, who can we get? You know, I don't know, Tony Blair wasn't that good, but, you know, there's a few people like that around the world. That Mary Robinson, she was the Human Rights Commissioner. We might get Al Gore. He's not doing much. You know, invite him up and just, you know, invite him to be Prime Minister of Australia. Interesting concept, isn't it? Because CEOs, a CEO of sort of Rio Tinto or BHP or no, that, those are multinationals anyway, Coles or Myers or somewhere, that's Australian companies. Do they have to be Australian to be the CEO of a company? If they do the good job, then why not? They can come along and just run our country for us. And if they don't do a good job, we don't have to, you know, de-elect them and just get sacked straight away, just like every other CEO. So this is my idea, to outsource the President of the United States. They can be an Australian. We could send a sort of Kevin Rudd. I don't know. You can understand the idea somewhere. Sorry, United States, I didn't mean that. But anyway, how can one maintain right intention in the leadership role? Is remember your inspiration. So sometimes just take time out. I mean, really mean time out, not with your wife or your husband. Time on retreats, where you really do have a retreat. So you can actually see a bigger picture. Because I think one of the problems with our leadership roles, you just have so much on, so much coming at you all at once. You know, you lose the inspiration of the big picture and are just reacting to events rather than being, say, this beautiful proactive. And, you know, see what real leadership is. You know, higher things, not just, you know, how are we going to pay the next bills, how are we going to... You know, is that really inspiring? Now, how we can balance the budget? Goodness sake, that's not inspiring. When I was a school teacher, I was only a school teacher for 1 year, I was invited to join one of the unions, the teachers' unions in UK. So I went to one of the meetings, and all they were talking about is how to get more money for the teachers. And I was just really just so fed up with that sort of attitude. What about making education better, you know, bigger classrooms, you know, better facilities? That's what I was interested in. But when it was just about money, 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 I just was lost all my interest in joining any union. It was not inspiring. You're a young man and you just want to do something good in the world, make it a better place, have more peace, harmony, give poor kids a chance, or disabled kids, get them into sort of the ordinary classes so they feel included rather than institutionalized and excluded outside. There's so many things you wanted to do, and all these people were saying about money, balancing the budget. Come on, that's not how to inspire Australians. You can have some higher goals, like, you know, winning the cricket final tomorrow. No, that's not a higher goal. No, you know what I'm talking about, it's giving people more meaning in life. So I think if you're in a leadership role, don't just think about just the bottom line. Think of the top line. You know, what people aspire to. And I think then the quality of working in a leadership role in a company. That's one thing which these places like Google try to do. You know, they're trying to sort of make it sort of a meaningful, useful, a cool company. Trying to change the culture, not just do more of the same. So they are leading. Anyway, from Spain, how should one deal with a boss who's not only arrogant and rude, but also not capable as a leader? The boss is unskilled and unqualified for the work and makes you do wrong things at work. Okay, if you've got a boss like that, it's not going to last very long. Unless, you know, you're working in politics. He's only arrogant and rude, not capable as a leader. Right, so why do we get people in such positions to begin with? And sometimes it's, how do bosses get elected? How do they get to those places? The worst of the worst of the worst. And sometimes that maybe that we should look at other qualities. One of the reasons is they get into those positions because what they promise to do for the company, what they promise to do for the country. And as I've been mentioning to many people, if you elect your leaders on what they promise to do, anyone can promise anything. If you elect your leaders on what they promise, you just get the most effective liars. You know, the ones who should be working in second-hand car yards, not in government, because they can sell a dodgy vehicle to anybody. So instead of on what people promise to do in the future, people should be elected to leadership roles on their record of what they've done in the past. So, you know, you find out, you know, before you elect them as your leader, as your boss, you know, how were they with other people? And it's not just how much money they made for the company. It's just their ability to work with each other. I went to a very beautiful HR conference. I gave a keynote there, but I also listened to this HR leader of the Department of Energy and Fisheries or something. It's where Ed Miliband made his move towards, you know, becoming the leader of the Labour Party. He was the minister there. And this HR leader told him, he said, look, you're running your department in a totally the wrong way. You know, you are rewarding and promoting people who get the contract signed with the European Union in Brussels, even though the cost of getting those contracts signed means many people are getting burnt out and they're leaving. We're losing our talent. Instead of rewarding the outcomes, you should be rewarding the processes. The people who actually really get a good submission in, but it doesn't pass the European Parliament this time. But these are really good people, they really worked hard and they really worked together. Those are the ones you should be promoting. Because you're promoting and encouraging the process, not the outcomes. Get the process right, the way people work together, not whether, you know, they get the profits or they get the sales, but how they do it. Reward that. And Miliband did that. Changed the whole culture in this ministry, and that's why he got promoted. And became a leader. So if you are going to be a boss, don't reward the outcomes. Those are short term. You know, the short term profits, the short term sales. We want to get a culture where people can work long term, really evolve their skills, be able, not just personal skills, but be able to work together skills, the cooperation skills. And then if we make that as our corporate culture, the processes, we reward those, we promote those who've got good process, not good outcomes. Then, in the long term, we won't have these terrible situations. We've got a bad boss who ruins companies, who stops innovation and stops people getting a livelihood. There's too many companies go bust that way because they're rewarding short-term outcomes, which anyone can do if you force hard enough, instead of the long-term sustainable process-driven companies. That's why here in the Buddhist Society of West Australia, we're process-driven. Not the outcomes, but just how well we do things. As I keep on telling everyone here, and when we're talking about the audit of our financial affairs at the AGM, when the auditor was asking about our assets, what is the assets of the membership of the Buddhist Society of West Australia? And I mentioned to the treasurer that our assets are you. The monks, the nuns, those are the assets. But you know, it's very hard to put that as an audited report. Now, how are you guarding the assets of the Buddhist Society? He said, by giving lovely talks like this, and by being friend, and by allowing you to go home early instead of going off to 9:30 if I don't stop now. That's how we look after our assets. Thank you very much for listening. Okay, so let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and if you want to sort of have a question afterwards, you're most welcome to. Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami